This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. This is the author, Alan Gannett. Preface. We've all been told a lie about the nature of creativity. For as long as anyone can remember, our culture has perpetuated the myth that creative success is a result of a sudden light bulb moment, that writing best-selling novels, creating revered paintings, or developing viral mobile apps has a mystical quality, unconnected to rational thought or logic, that is reserved for geniuses rather than for the rest of us mere mortals. In fact, for centuries now, we have been persuaded of this by wise men and critics who excitedly recount stories of creative genius that emphasize the individual, the subconscious, and the seemingly divine machinations behind creative achievement. My goal in writing The Creative Curve is to reveal the truth about creative success, that there is, in fact, a science behind what becomes a hit, and that today's neuroscience gives us an unprecedented ability to decode and engineer the necessary moments of inspiration to create popular work that your audience can't get enough of. I have always been addicted to patterns. As a kid, this took the form of spending countless hours playing computer games, watching and waiting to see how the AI worked so I could destroy my virtual opponent and save the kingdom, or planet, or country. I think you get the idea. As a teenager, this turned into a short-lived and fairly successful obsession with getting cast on game shows. Today, this lifelong geekery has found two homes. By day, I run a company that works with large brands to help them uncover the meaning, that is to say, the patterns, within their marketing data. We help Fortune 500s and high-growth startups understand the marketing channels, messages, and tactics that will work the best in the future based on the data from their past. By night, I've done everything possible to answer the question of whether there is a pattern to creative success. I've spent the last 2 years interviewing some of the world's most successful creators, from culinary titans to best-selling novelists and even top YouTube creators. I sat down, ate, chatted, and Skyped with some of the leading so-called creative geniuses of our time. In addition, I spoke to the most distinguished academics in the studies of creativity, genius, and neuroscience. What did I find? It turns out that the mythology around creativity is just that, myth. You do not have to be born with some X-Men-like superpower to achieve great artistic or entrepreneurial heights. In fact, there is a pattern that successful creative people leverage to make hits, one that's accessible to almost anyone. It's intuitive, but it's also learnable. And it has nothing to do with mysticism. You don't need to take LSD to get inspired or pray for a moment of overwhelming insight. Based on what I found, it turns out you can intentionally follow what the world's most vaunted creative geniuses do and get that much closer to creating and executing your own great ideas. Let's get started. Part 1. Overturning the mythology of creativity. Chapter 1. The Making of a Dream. It was November 1963. Paul McCartney woke up obsessed with a melody he had heard while dreaming. The 21-year-old pop star stumbled over to the small piano nestled in his room on the top floor of 57 Wimpole Street in central London. What was that melody? He sat at the piano, trying to recreate the notes he had heard in his sleep. It felt so familiar. He finally put it together. G, F sharp minor 7th, B, E minor, and E. He played it again and again. He loved the way it sounded, but was certain the melody must come from some half-forgotten song he had heard before. Like many musicians, he fretted that he might be borrowing the melody of another song. Too familiar, he thought. Where have I heard this before? The melody McCartney heard in his dream would ultimately become Yesterday, the most recorded song in music history, with 3,000 different versions. It has been played more than 7 million times on American television and radio, and is the fourth highest grossing song of all time. McCartney himself once said of his famous song, "It is possibly the smash of this century." Indeed, Yesterday may well have been one of the 20th century's biggest hits, and apparently, it was the result of a dream. He told an interviewer for the Beatles anthology that the experience had a profound impact on how he viewed creativity. He said, "It's amazing that it just came to me in a dream. That's why I don't profess to know anything. I think music is all very mystical." For creativity researchers, Paul McCartney's sudden melodic epiphany is a classic example of creativity coming to an artist unplanned, in a flash of genius, a moment of inspiration in which an idea suddenly rises to one's conscious awareness. It is the unexpected nature of these bursts of inspiration, with no apparent origin, that gives them a supernatural quality. Anyone who has had a great idea in the shower or on a run or walk has experienced some version of these moments. Whether it is J.K. Rowling being struck with the idea for Harry Potter on a train to London, or Mozart being able to compose songs without effort, these accounts have become modern-day staples of what I call the inspiration theory of creativity. The idea that creative success results from a mysterious internal process punctuated by unpredictable flashes of genius. And our culture has embraced the idea that a self-reliant person born with the right innate talents can produce hits out of sheer inspiration. What's more, this view is not confined to the traditional arts like music and literature. Steve Jobs, the prototypical genius of the digital age, explained in an often repeated quote that creativity is an organic process. He said, "When you ask creative people how they did something, they feel a little guilty because they didn't really do it. They just saw something." The inspiration theory of creativity dominates how most people think about creative greatness today. But why do these sudden moments of inspiration occur? Is sheer IQ genius the only explanation? If we studied the settings of these creative moments, would they verify or disprove the inspiration theory? Name that tune. The morning the melody for Yesterday came to McCartney was a typical lazy day. As was his routine, he awoke around noon. He and his girlfriend Jane would often stay out late at London's restaurants and clubs. McCartney worried about why the melody he woke up with was so clear, so concise. It seemed too finished, too complete. He assumed he had accidentally plagiarized it. Was it from one of the classics he had heard his father play so often? Stairway to Paradise, Chicago, Lullaby of the Leaves? The Beatles were thoughtful about creating their hits. Lennon once described to an interviewer how intentional the band had been when writing their first number one single, "Please Please Me." "We tried to make it as simple as possible. We aimed this one straight at the hit parade. It was my attempt at writing a Roy Orbison song." For McCartney, Yesterday was an explicit exception to his typical methodical songwriting process. "The tune of Yesterday was like a jazz melody," McCartney later said. He continued, "My dad used to know a lot of old jazz tunes. I thought maybe I just remembered it from the past." He went to his friends and asked if they recognized the song. First, he asked his songwriting partner, John Lennon. Lennon told him he had never heard it before. Still skeptical, McCartney tried his friend Lionel Bart, who had composed numerous hit songs. When McCartney hummed the melody, Bart drew a blank. It seemed as if the song might be original. Still not convinced, McCartney pressed on. He tried to think of someone older and more experienced, someone who might be able to clear his conscience. A few days later, McCartney visited Alma Cogan, a British singer known for the song Dreamboat and 16 other hits. If anyone could recognize the song, she could. He sat down at the piano and played the melody for Kogan and her sister. "It's lovely," Kogan said when he was done. Had she heard it before? McCartney asked. Was it someone else's song? Kogan said, "No, it's original. Nice song." Finally, McCartney was persuaded. He had seemingly dreamed a masterful melody following the mystical nature of the inspiration theory of creativity. We can interpret the inspiration theory in one of two ways. The positive view is that a flash of genius can strike anyone. Yesterday came to McCartney in a dream, outside of his control. It's possible that all of us can dream a chart-topping melody. On the other hand, most of us believe that if we lack the raw talent or innate genius, these moments will never strike. The inspiration theory of creativity is only relevant for those born with so-called genius. As a result, many of us are tempted to put aside any ambition to become the next great musician, novelist, or entrepreneur, settling instead to be a consumer or patron of the arts. Meanwhile, the optimistic ones are just waiting, hoping for a sudden flash of inspiration to visit them. The inspiration theory is supported by countless anecdotes from the creative artists of our time. Authors talk of waiting for creative inspiration. Entrepreneurs talk of waiting for a great idea to strike. Musicians talk of falling into a creative groove. There are countless books and blog posts on creativity, offering suggestions on how we can push through writer's block or discover our flow. Biopics of great artists amplify the inevitability of their creativity, as well as suggesting it is the domain of mad geniuses. Meanwhile, the rest of us are left on the sidelines. But what if this entire theory is wrong? What if you don't have to wait for lightning to strike? The Road to Yesterday. While the sudden creation story of yesterday is relatively well known, what is less known is how McCartney went from the original melody to crafting the full song. The notion that this song came to McCartney in an instant is wrong. All that had come to him in the dream was a simple chord progression. When McCartney awoke with a melody in his head, it was a long way from a completed song. For one thing, the tune had no words. He knew he needed to come up with placeholder lyrics while he continued working on the song's structure. As he was playing the melody to Alma Cogan, her mother walked into the room asking, "Anyone like some scrambled eggs?" This gave McCartney the temporary lyric he needed, scrambled eggs. The initial lyrics he came up with were, scrambled eggs, oh my baby, how I love your legs, diddle diddle, I believe in scrambled eggs. From there, it took almost 20 months of grueling work to complete the song. McCartney became obsessed. While he worked on it, the people around McCartney became sick of hearing about his ever-changing song in progress. As George Harrison told an interviewer about that period, "He's always talking about that song. You'd think he was Beethoven or somebody." Even when the Beatles started filming their second movie, Help, McCartney didn't waver. He worked on the song during breaks. At one point, the film's producer, Dick Lester, was so fed up that he said, "If you play that bloody song any longer, I'll have the piano taken off stage. Either finish it or give it up." Later, on their first tour through France, Paul had a piano placed in their hotel room so that he could continue working on Yesterday. It paid off. When producer George Martin first heard the song, he was mesmerized. It was different. In fact, it was so original that he was worried that it wouldn't fit into a Beatles album. McCartney realized that the song needed melancholy lyrics. Scrambled eggs were not a valid topic for a brooding song. He said, "I remember thinking that people liked sad tunes. They like to wallow a bit when they're alone, to put a record on and go, ah." He finally finished the song, sketching out the final lyrics on a trip to Portugal in May 1965. A month later, he went to the studio with George Martin to record Yesterday. According to Martin, McCartney came into Studio 2 at EMI and played Yesterday on an acoustic guitar. The only change Martin could think of was adding orchestral strings. Paul, however, thought that was too much. In response, Martin suggested a quartet, and with that melodic but dark addition, Yesterday was born. The iconic song that is remembered as a result of a flash of genius was, in fact, a nearly 2-year odyssey, one that at times wore McCartney and his friends down. While the mythology behind the Beatles celebrates the story of Yesterday as one of sudden creative genius, as we've seen, it was hardly a linear path from dream to recording. Yesterday was not a pure product of a lightbulb moment. It was hard, grueling work. But couldn't you argue that it began with an initial moment of divine inspiration? How do we account for that? There is a cottage industry of researchers who are fascinated by the origin story of Yesterday. Academics interested in creativity, music historians, and avid Beatles fans. All have worked to answer the question of where the melody really came from. The most enlightening theory of the origin of Yesterday comes from Beatles expert Ian Hammond, who points out that the song, quote, is a direct evolution of the melody from the Ray Charles version of Georgia on My Mind. Not only does Yesterday share a chord progression with the earlier song, but it also mirrors the bass lines of Georgia on My Mind. True enough, the Beatles and Paul McCartney were big admirers of Ray Charles. They kicked off their career playing his covers in the bars and clubs of Hamburg, Germany. John Lennon said that when they started playing their own songs, it was a, quote, quite traumatic thing because we were doing such great numbers of other people's, of Ray Charles and Little Richard and all of them. For Paul McCartney, what looked like divine inspiration was in fact likely the result of subconscious processing of music he loved. Like most music, it was an evolution of the chord progressions that already existed. In fact, as Hammond points out, Ray Charles's version of Georgia on My Mind was an evolution of Hoagy Carmichael's original version of the song. This type of ingestion, reinvention, and influence is common in stories of creative success. When McCartney reflects on how he wrote Yesterday, he tends to focus on his sudden inspiration for the tune. But, in at least one interview, he acknowledged that there was something more mechanical at work. He said, "If you're very spiritual, then God sent me a melody. I'm a mere vehicle. If you want to be a bit more cynical, then I was loading my computer for millions of years listening to all the stuff I listened to through my dad and through my musical tastes, including people like Fred Astaire, Gershwin, and finally, my computer printed out one morning what it thought was a good tune." The things we view as unexplainable genius often have a genesis of some sort. The inspiration theory of creativity has been around for thousands of years, since the era of ancient Greece. While the theory is still breathlessly recounted in the press, modern research that I'll discuss demonstrates that creative potential is within all of us. However, if our perception of McCartney and other creative artists is flawed, if they are more accurately described as tirelessly and intensely focused, that still does not explain how they achieved commercial success. Plenty of artists toil away for years at their crafts without recognition or acclaim. An endless procession of novelists has labored tirelessly for years writing novels that never sell a copy. Many painters, sculptors, choreographers, and musicians work for years without ever tasting critical or commercial success. Clearly, popular success is not just a matter of sweat equity. Could it be possible to identify the true causes of creative success? Chapter 2, Learning a Lie. As I said earlier, I've always been addicted to recognizing patterns. Much of the phenomena we observe that seem organic or unique are actually the result of repeating processes and systems. By decoding the right patterns, I believe you can achieve goals ranging from the frivolous to the meaningful. When I was 18, I set my sights on getting on a game show. It seemed like an unusual challenge, yet one that offered a potentially fun and lucrative reward. So I applied to all the shows I had heard of, and some I hadn't known existed. Some asked for essays, others, like Jeopardy, asked you to take online tests. Still others, like Wheel of Fortune, simply requested you fill out a form. I sent away emails and filled out web forms, and then I waited. After months of not hearing anything, one day an email appeared asking me to audition for Wheel of Fortune. Rather than study the puzzles, I decided I would spend the weeks before my audition trying to figure out what the producers wanted. I watched dozens of episodes, looking for common elements in the contestants' behavior. I delved through message boards about how the game worked, and read blog posts about other people's experiences auditioning. After hours of research, I found a pattern. The casting team wasn't looking for expert puzzle solvers. They were seeking contestants who could enunciate, and really loudly too, were willing to embarrass themselves, and who came across to a home audience as over-the-top and energetic. That's why, instead of studying vocab words, I came up with various ways I could embarrass myself. I worked on an Elmo impression that I thought might make the audience laugh, or cringe, and on the morning of my audition, I drank 2 shots of espresso. A lack of energy would not be an obstacle. It worked. That year, I was cast on Wheel of Fortune. While I lost to Joanne from Virginia, I really should have studied the puzzles, I now had a hypothesis. Television producers were looking for a particular type of individual, with energy whom, with practice, I could emulate. I wanted to prove to myself that my success at getting cast was repeatable and not a fluke. So I auditioned for another game show. A few months later, I was cast on MTV's Movers and Changers, a cheesy business competition hosted by Nick Cannon. The show was similar to what Shark Tank would later become, and again, I lost. My business idea was judged by some well-known personalities like CNBC's Jim Cramer, who voted me off the proverbial island, or as he would say, sell, sell, sell. Eventually, my preoccupation with patterns led to more serious endeavors. While this book is not a marketing book, although marketers will be able to apply these concepts, many of these observations grew out of my frustrations as a marketer. In 2011, I had become a CMO of a venture-backed startup, and I wanted to improve our performance. Once again, I sought out patterns. I pored through our campaign and audience analytics, and lo and behold, I ended up with data that revealed how we could improve our efforts. I was able to uncover the topics and tactics that resonated with our audience. However, finding these patterns took hours of manual work and was incredibly tedious. So in 2012, I quit my job and founded TrackMaven, a company that provides predictive analytics to marketers. I wanted to automate what I had been doing before with spreadsheets and Excel formulas. Some of the world's biggest brands now hire TrackMaven to decode their marketing data. Our software is built on the premise that if you look at millions of pieces of marketing content from a brand, you'll find patterns that answer valuable questions. Should the financial services company invest more in Facebook advertising? What is better for the retail brand to talk about on its blog, discounts or new items? Is there an ideal number of emails a company should send before customers start pressing the unsubscribe button? Our platform makes it straightforward for companies to answer these questions. Since its founding, the company has been in growth overdrive. We've raised more than $28 million in institutional capital, have worked with hundreds of companies ranging from the Fortune 500s to high-growth startups, and were named one of the fastest-growing companies in America, according to the Inc. 500. Since we ingest data from some of the world's biggest brands, we see data that no one else sees. With this unique perspective, I found another surprising pattern. Most marketers are failing. Marketing is supposed to be one of the most creative parts of business. Yet, according to the Content Marketing Institute, only 30% of consumer marketers believe that their content works. Another study found that only 2.8% of business-to-business marketing campaigns achieve their targets. Failure has become the status quo for most marketers. Why, I asked, are some of the most creative people in organizations failing? To answer this question, I went on the road to meet with numerous marketers. I wanted to understand why they were more often than not coming up short. Were they creating too much content, too little? How could the statistics around success be so uniformly negative? What I found was that today's marketers are following the wrong patterns. They tend to use words like innovation, collaboration, and brainstorming. To me, that is really industry speak for a group of people waiting around for a light bulb moment. Like those who believe in the inspiration myth, they believe great campaign ideas will simply strike them at the right time. Marketers are unconsciously following the traditional myth of the inspiration theory of creativity in their careers and in their offices. What do I mean by that? They design the layout of their offices to foster brainstorming. Conference rooms and whiteboards are scattered everywhere, as if their mere presence might unleash pent-up creativity. According to one trade group, almost 70% of all offices are now designed as open spaces meant to encourage collaboration and cross-pollination. And sure, companies and teams are brainstorming more than ever before. Nevertheless, across the board, most marketers' content does not become viral or ignite sales. Clearly, the open office plans and whiteboard bonanza are not fostering a new era of creativity. Nor is that approach just embraced by marketers. I met with creators from all backgrounds and trades, from painters to chefs to writers to entrepreneurs. I found that across every creative discipline, people have adopted the inspiration theory of creativity as their model for finding, stumbling upon really, mainstream success. The writers I know, the entrepreneurs I know, even the artists I know, try to optimize for moments of sudden brilliance. But even with all the focus on brainstorming and inspiration, most novels fail, most startups go bankrupt, and most artists never take off. Throughout creative fields, the most followed pattern of creativity, one of free association and free-flowing thought, is falling short. Worse, too many people with passion, buying into the notion that creativity is the province of geniuses, give up even trying to be creators. They abandon their dreams and become consumers of culture, rather than creators of it. A recent global study of 5,000 people found that only 25% believe they are fulfilling their creative potential. On the other hand, there are a handful of creative geniuses, from Pablo Picasso to Steve Jobs, who do achieve large-scale commercial success. How do they do it? And why are the results for most of us so bad? Are these creative geniuses born with an instinct for turning ideas into things to be revered? Are they just lucky? Or is there something beyond our understanding at play? Do most of us have no chance at achieving mainstream success? To answer these questions, I decided to reverse engineer creative success. What does it take to create a hit? Whether a hit restaurant, a hit screenplay, or a popular poem? Is there a pattern? Is creative success something you can practice, hone, and enhance? I tackled the problem by going right to the source. I spoke with people who had reached the pinnacle of creative and commercial achievement. I wanted to uncover what the world's most successful people did to unlock their potential, even if they couldn't put exact words to it. Flying around the world to meet painters and chefs, Skyping with rock stars entrepreneurs, I interviewed dozens of creative geniuses on their process, asking about their childhoods, their brainstorming process, and even the layouts of their workspaces. I wanted to see if I could find any dots that would connect. I met these people through a variety of circumstances. Sometimes it was as simple as reaching out to them via email. I contacted others through layers of managers. And many were introduced through mutual connections. I also devoured the latest science on creativity, interviewing academics who are using the latest tools and technologies to decode genius, and poring over thousands of pages of peer-reviewed articles and journals. I wanted to learn if science could help us explain what it takes to create a hit. What was the result of my investigation? Not only did I discover the hidden patterns I was looking for, I learned something surprising and exciting, that the inspiration theory of creativity simply isn't true. In fact, as I will show, studies prove that the majority of us are born with the same creative potential as artists who create hit after hit. I also learned that there is an evolutionary basis for what commands dollars and attention, that successful ideas are not born of mysterious origins, and that what we think of as flashes of genius are actually a biological process that anyone can cultivate. In short, I learned that there is a science and a method to achieving mainstream success, one that anyone can work to master. In this book, I will walk you through the patterns I found. This is not a marketing book. It is not a self-help book. It is simply a guide to understanding the patterns of creativity that result in breakthrough success. You will learn the history of creative thought and how it has developed from the time of the Greeks to today's fast-paced world of Snapchat and Instagram. You will discover the neuroscience that underpins the creation of trends. Finally, you will uncover the four patterns that successful creative people follow to increase their odds of achieving mainstream success, and you will understand the science that explains why they work. As you will find out, while this is a conscious process for some, most creators follow these patterns unconsciously as the result of similar methods of early instruction and learning. A word of caution. The standard academic definition of creativity is the ability to make something that is novel and that also has value. It is a mistake to think that creativity is just about creating something different or original. It also has to be valuable, meaning that a group of people, large or small, have found importance or usefulness in that creative product. A pop star who creates a hit song has created something novel and of value. An entrepreneur who creates a viral app is worthy of study. This means that my exploration will not just be focused on the traditional painters and artists you might see at the Getty Museum or the Louvre. While I will talk about many of those traditional creators, I will also include numerous contemporary artists, entrepreneurs, creative individuals, and companies like the Flavor Team at Ben & Jerry's. As a result, I'll also dive into the science of trends. Trends signify that a large group of people agrees that something, a song, a product, or idea, has value. As far as trends are concerned, research identifies two seemingly contradictory urges in the human psyche. People crave the familiar, yet seek the novel. To protect ourselves from the unknown, we seek the familiar. For example, the comfort of our own home or the company of close friends. We also seek the stimulation and potential rewards of novel and unusual things. Anyone who has wanted to try a new restaurant or listen to a new song knows what I am talking about. Studies show that the tension between these contradictory urges creates a bell-shaped curve relationship between preference and familiarity. As individuals or groups are exposed to something, they like it more and more with each additional exposure until it reaches a peak of popularity. At that point, it becomes overexposed, and each additional exposure leads to lower popularity. I call this bell-shaped curve the creative curve. Sociologists, psychologists, and economists have known about and have been writing about these contradictory urges and the bell-shaped curve they produce for decades. In his 1967 book, Man's Rage for Chaos, Morris Peckham explained how this paradox drives our cultural aesthetic. Almost 50 years later, Jonah Berger's 2016 book, Invisible Influence, described how ideas that are similar but different have the most social influence. Even more recently, Derek Thompson's book, Hitmakers, describes how 20th century industrial designers observe this phenomenon in a principle called Most Advanced Yet Acceptable. What nobody has described, however, is how to find the sweet spot on the creative curve, the point of optimal tension between preference and familiarity, safety and surprise, similarity and difference. In the course of my interviews and research, I discovered that popular creators, consciously or unconsciously, have developed a method for doing just this, whether they're able to articulate it or not. What is called creative genius is really the ability to understand the mechanics of the creative curve and use it to engineer mainstream success. Regardless of the industries they work in, the innovators I interviewed make use of shockingly similar methods. They understand what is familiar and use novelty in ways they know their audience will respond to. They then slowly change their artistic style to drive continued interest in their work. The methods these creators have learned to master the creative curve are what I call the laws of the creative curve. In the course of the book, I will outline and explain these four laws: the law of consumption, the law of imitation, the law of creative communities, and the law of iterations. Creative geniuses consistently outperform the rest of society by either subconsciously or consciously utilizing the laws of the creative curve to develop a scalable system of success that helps them discover or create ideas that combine just the right blend of familiar and novel. For each law, I will explain the scientific thinking that underlies it, as well as offer practical examples of how to use it. The good news is that these laws can apply to any creative field or creative person. Again, the traditional view of creativity implies that we all exist in a world of infinite possibilities and must wait for a novel idea to cut through the noise. We are told that serendipitous moments can occur unpredictably anytime while we're in the shower, on our commute, or in the boardroom. In this book, I will disprove this, and I will break down the science behind the creative curve, providing you with a methodology that will enable you to maximize your odds of creating a hit, no matter the industry. Chapter 3: The Origin of the Myth. The inspiration theory of creativity suggests that creativity is a mysterious internal process, roiling and churning inside us, punctuated by flashes of insight that bubble to the surface without warning. In short, creativity, as most of us have come to understand it, is a random gift from God. However, there are two additional elements of the inspiration theory. First, that you have to be a traditional, or IQ, genius to be struck by creative ideas. And second, that it helps to be a little bit neurotic or manic. In other words, creative brilliance is innate. We're born with it or we aren't. And being a bit different tends to come with it. You often see this theory highlighted in our entertainment. It was on full display in the movie adaptation of Amadeus, which won 8 Academy Awards in 1985, including Best Picture. Amadeus depicts Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's bristling relationship with Antonio Salieri, who saw himself as Mozart's rival. The movie shows a blindfolded Mozart as a child playing piano flawlessly to kings and popes. It claims that Mozart, a prodigy with mesmerizing talent, composed his first concerto at 4 years old. In the film, Salieri toils relentlessly on his compositions, reworking them again and again, when he discovers that Mozart, now a young man, creates impeccable first drafts with no signs of editing or revisions, he is furious. In one scene, Salieri gazes at a finished Mozart composition. Astounding! It was actually beyond belief. These were first and only drafts of music, yet they showed no corrections of any kind. Here again was the very voice of God. Salieri was both awestruck and envious. Divine music seemed to just flow out of Mozart. What's more, Mozart, at least as he was portrayed in the film, was an immature drunk who didn't take himself seriously. Many of us consider Mozart to be the embodiment of the inspiration theory of creativity. Famed movie critic Roger Ebert said that Amadeus's characterization of Mozart was not a vulgarization of Mozart, but a way of dramatizing that true geniuses rarely take their own work seriously because it comes so easily for them. The film's portrayal has its origins in a letter written by Mozart that was published in 1815 by a leading German music magazine. The magazine's publisher was an avid fan of and expert on the composer, telling all who would listen stories about how Mozart would compose in his head without benefit of a piano. In the letter, Mozart explained his composition process. "Provided I am not disturbed, my subject enlarges itself, becomes methodized and defined, and the whole, though it be long, stands almost finished and complete in my mind, so that I can survey it, like a fine picture or a beautiful statue at a glance. Nor do I hear in my imagination the parts successively, but I hear them, as it were, all at once." This letter became a cornerstone of the mythology that grew around Mozart. The brilliant composer did not toil for his musical ideas. He was handed them by a mysterious higher power. This account, like countless other popular stories that refer to flashes of genius, can be enough to dissuade any aspiring individual who is not convinced they are a genius connected to God to give up his creative efforts. If you are not born with a once-in-a-generation gift, you don't stand a chance of making your mark. There is one problem with Mozart's letter. It was a forgery. The portrait of Mozart's inspired brilliance came about as the result of an overly ambitious publisher trying to sell magazines. Johann Rochlitz was a German magazine publisher who had a deep reverence for Mozart and published countless letters and anecdotes that were purportedly from or about Mozart. However, later biographers discovered that many of his stories were exaggerated, and some, such as this letter, were wholly fabricated. Nevertheless, the myth took hold. A few hundred years later, this conception of Mozart is still deeply ingrained in our consciousness. In reality, Mozart worked long hours in a highly iterative, back-breaking process. He described a set of string quartets he composed as the fruit of long and laborious effort. Mozart would create numerous sketches, the music composer's equivalent of rough drafts, as he worked through various parts of his compositions. Mozart even used a type of shorthand for drafting that made it easier for him to edit his work. The idea that Mozart composed pieces entirely in his head was also not true. In his actual letters, he makes it very clear that he wrote at a keyboard, as he needed to hear the notes as he was working. Another aspect of the Mozart myth was that he was a child prodigy, born with unprecedented gifts. According to Salieri and Amadeus, Mozart composed his first concertos at the age of 4. In reality, the first piano concerto he wrote was at age 11, after years of daily focused practice insisted upon by his father. But these first pieces, it turns out, were not actually original, but instead were reinterpretations of others' songs. His father began training Mozart in music when he was 3 years old. And Mozart's first truly original concerto was written when he was 17 years old. This may still seem young, but at that point, Mozart had almost 14 years of intense practice behind him. 14 years of long, daily practice is not the same as being simply born a world-class composer. Finally, Mozart and Salieri were actually friends. Yes, they sometimes competed for jobs, but outside of friendly competition, they enjoyed each other's company, composed a piece together, Per la cupriata salute di Ophelia. And Salieri was, in fact, Mozart's son's music teacher for a time. Mozart An early standard bearer for the inspiration theory of creativity was, in fact, a practitioner of intense and diligent effort. Yet the inspiration theory of creativity shows up not just in pop culture and films, but also in mainstream media and academia. The New York Times columnist David Brooks, in a 2016 piece about creativity, argues that inspiration is not something you can control. He does not believe it is merely a result of hard work. Brooks goes on, "People who are inspired have lost some agency." He continues, "They often feel that something is working through them, some power greater than themselves. The Greeks said it was the muses. Believers might say it is God or the Holy Spirit. Others might say it is something mysterious, bursting forth deep in the unconscious, a new way of seeing." Brooks suggests that such inspiration is beyond comprehension. This idea that creativity is something somewhat mystical runs rampant through Western civilization. Academic researchers seem especially obsessed with the idea that genius is some superior form of humanity. A review of PhD dissertations on the topic of creativity found that 6 out of 10 focus on it as an individual phenomenon. Yet, as we'll see, this aspect of the inspiration theory of creativity, too, is a myth. Like Mozart's forged letter, it has been embellished and amplified by critics for hundreds of years. To recap, there are 4 main elements of this myth. First, it is an individual act, the domain of the solo genius born with these talents. Second, the moments of brilliance come as sudden epiphanies that overtake the creator, such as with the creation of yesterday. Third, that once overtaken by inspiration, success comes easily. Fourth and finally, creative people like Mozart are somewhat mad, neurotic, or manic, and often all 3. As you'll see, these ideas are either exaggerated or worse, as with Mozart, made up. But where do these ideas even come from? If they're not true, why have so many come to believe the inspiration myth? And what is the actual truth about creative talent? The history of creativity. A poet is a light and winged thing, and holy, and never able to compose until he has become inspired and is beside himself, and reason is no longer in him. If you believe this is another David Brooks quote, you're only off by a couple thousand years. Plato said it. Much of our modern perspective on creativity goes all the way back to the early Greeks. Plato considered an artist to be one who imitated the reality that God created. In fact, the word that the Greeks used to describe an artist's work is mimesis, which means to imitate. Plato expanded on this view of artists, saying, "These lovely poems are not of man or human workmanship, but are divine and from the gods, and that poets are nothing but interpreters of the gods, each one possessed by the divinity to whom he is in bondage." Plato and the Greeks provide the historical underpinning for the idea that a creative person is a possessed soul, channeling ideas from the gods. The Latin term for genius means a spirit that possesses and protects an individual, a concept that transferred over to the Greeks. The Greeks also introduced the idea that artists are different from the rest of us. Plato calls the state that poets enter delirium. Aristotle, too, picks up this same refrain, saying that when mania strikes, many persons become poets, prophets, and sibyls, and are pretty good poets while they are maniacal, but when cured, can no longer write verse. Genius, it seemed, was intertwined with madness. The Greeks, therefore, provided a handful of ideas essential to the inspiration theory of creativity. Artists were divinely inspired and the result of a manic, spiritual possession. The role of an artist continued to develop throughout the ages. Visiting medieval times. Today, great artists are heralded in museums and galleries. Auction houses sell famous works for hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of dollars. However, in the medieval view of creativity, the artist was merely an imitator, copying God's reality. Accordingly, early Western society viewed artists as mere craftspeople. Over a phone call, Professor Deborah Haynes, who's written numerous art history books, told me these early artists were ranked in the social order below merchants and only a rung above slaves. There was no concept of a famous artist. Most pieces of art were unsigned. In part, this was because art was typically a collective effort, created in workshops. What's more, most of the work artists created was not original. Instead, artists followed strict guidelines by imitating the recurring political and religious art required by churches and civic organizations. Artists were skilled workers, nothing more divine than that. They would be analogous to today's trained carpenters or bricklayers. But as time went on, and European countries prospered through trading, the market for art exploded. A rising class of merchants was eager to spend their wealth and live like kings. Rich noblemen still wanted to decorate their palaces, and churches continued to want awe-inspiring frescoes and sculptures. This increased hunger for art resulted in two significant changes in the Western art world. First, the interest in their work gave artists a small taste of power. Emboldened, they began engaging in collective bargaining. They joined guilds, an early form of unions, which mandated working conditions, tools, costs, and even techniques. These guilds elevated the artist to a higher place in the social pecking order. However, according to Deborah Haynes, as individual artists began to prosper, they began to split off from the guilds and work directly for the new patronage class. The newfound wealth of the patrons and their insatiable desire for art led to the onset of the Italian Renaissance. Very soon, there emerged the notion of the artist as an individual. For the first time, there were even famous artists, men such as Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo. As their work became more coveted, artists pushed for the culture to view them as superior, almost heroic individuals. The patrons were willing to oblige. And for the first time, established artists were seen as creative geniuses, with egos to match. A pope and a brothel. A Vatican official was aghast as he looked up at the fresco painted by Michelangelo on the altar of the Sistine Chapel. The painting depicted God's final judgment after Jesus' second coming. Yet, unlike most religious paintings of the time, many people in this painting were proudly naked. Nude caricatures were not unprecedented, but typically they would be portrayed as somewhat ashamed of their nudity. The Last Judgment is one of the most important works of the Italian Renaissance. Nonetheless, Biagio da Cesena, an aide to the Pope, told people it was a work suited for a wall in a bagno, or brothel. Michelangelo was incensed by Biagio's criticism. He alone had decided to strip the saints, and he would not be bullied by some bureaucrat. He decided to take revenge by adding a figure to the painting. Biagio, the official, portrayed as Minos, the judge of the dead. What's more, in the painting, the figure based on Biagio had a snake wrapped around him, not once, but twice, symbolizing that he was in the second circle of hell, or where Dante would put the lustful and perverse. In a final rebuke, the snake was painted in such a way that appeared to be gnawing on Biagio's genitals. Not surprisingly, Biagio was furious. Who did this Michelangelo think he was? Biagio complained directly to the Pope, but the Pope refused to intervene. According to one account, the Pope told Biagio, "My authority does not extend into hell." Michelangelo was demonstrating the newfound power of the celebrity artists, capable of standing up to high-ranking religious officials. This story has been handed down through history thanks in part to Giorgio Vasari, a writer during the Italian Renaissance who penned one of the first works of art history, an encyclopedia of Italian artists with brief biographical sketches. It helped to canonize the included artists. In his book, Vasari also defines the Renaissance view of creativity. He explains that while the ancient Greeks saw artists as simply copying God's work, and medieval rulers believed that artists were mere craftsmen, the Renaissance culture believed that artists weren't just copying God, they were actually God-like. And the master, that divine light infused by special grace into us, which has not only made us superior to the other animals, but, if it be not sin to say it, like to God. No longer did only God create, but artists created things as well. In addition, the Renaissance philosophers, and specifically Vasari, began to establish a link between intelligence and creativity. Whereas earlier thinkers viewed artists as lowly craftspeople whose job descriptions could best be summarized as imitating, Vasari focuses on the intelligence of great artists. Of one great painter, he writes, "Although he applied himself to the art of painting very late when already grown up, nevertheless, he was so well assisted by nature, which inclined him to this, and by his intelligence, which was very beautiful, that soon he produced therein marvelous fruits." This pervasive thinking led to artists migrating from learning in workshops to studying in prestigious art academies, the first of which was created by Vasari himself, with the financial backing of Duke Medici. Not only were artists now fiercely intelligent, godlike creators, some artists even improved on reality with their art. The English Renaissance expanded on this line of thinking. The poet Philip Sidney wrote, "Nature never set forth the earth in such rich tapestry as divers poets have done." However, the artist was still viewed as mad. Shakespeare wrote, "The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact." Artists had become like gods, albeit somewhat neurotic and manic. You can rejoice if you've ever been described as such. Of Monsters and Men. He shouted out, "We will each write a ghost story." George Gordon Byron, the 28-year-old famed romantic poet, had cabin fever. Huddled at his lake house, Byron and his friends had spent the summer of 1816 surrounded by rain and darkness, thanks to a volcanic eruption which had turned winter into a 12-month season. And the trip to the lakeside had devolved into countless hours stuck inside the house. To kill time, George and his friends had started reading aloud a book of German ghost stories. It was under these conditions that George laid out his challenge, that each of them write a ghost story. Among them was 18-year-old Mary, the lover of another cabin guest, Percy. Mary and Percy had run off 2 years earlier and had been traveling the world. Her parents were both well-known literary giants, but she was still trying to find her way in the world. As she sat beside Percy, she was stumped. What kind of ghost story could she write? Hours turned to days. George and Percy both started piecing together their ghoulish tales. Percy would ask Mary about her progress, but she had nothing. One day, she overheard Percy and George talking about a recent scientific finding. A botanist had claimed to observe microscopic animals that continued to move, seemingly after their own deaths. The men talked about the idea of a human corpse coming back to life. With all the scientific advancement of the day, it did not seem impossible. This conversation was all Mary needed to start writing her ghost story, and soon she had a short story completed. Encouraged by the feedback she got, the story eventually grew into a novel that she published anonymously 2 years later. She named the novel Frankenstein. Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley was only 20 years old when her book was published, yet the young writer had created a gripping tale that has survived for generations. Her story, again, is based on a stereotype of the creative genius, a brilliant scientist who goes mad and uses his expertise to create a monster. Shelley was part of the English Romantic movement. The Romantics believe that geniuses were mad and born with an innate talent that allowed them to create paintings, poems, and works of literature. Godlike, but somewhat crazy, they were able to create whole worlds with their paintbrushes and pencils.